You're very welcome to the ESG Factor podcast, brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. This series focuses on the practical integration of environmental, social and governance, or ESG factors, hence the name the ESG Factor. In this series, we'll have in-depth interviews with those working across ESG and equities, bonds, property and hedge funds. And we'll tell you a little more about that at the end of the episode. This episode will focus on impact investing, and I'll hand you over to Vincent to explain more.
Thanks, Eimear. There's an area of responsible investing that really excites me after working in impact investing in Guatemala in 2017. The origin of the term impact investing is actually in the philanthropic space, with the Rockefeller Foundation laying claim to the term. According to their website, in 2007, the term impact investing was coined at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center, putting a name to investments with the intention of generating both financial return and social and or environmental impact. Over the last few years, impact investing has gone much more mainstream, moving into private equity and public equity. Our guest today is Sarah Norris. She's an experienced investment director with Aberdeen Standard Investments. She's the co-portfolio manager for the Global Equity Impact Fund, which invests in companies that can prove a measurable positive impact on contributing to our society and environment. Sarah has studied English, peace and conflict studies, and international relations. Prior to joining Aberdeen Standard, she worked on a campaign in the US focused on upholding the outcome of the Sudanese referendum. So, Sarah, perhaps before we get into the investment stuff, you can maybe tell us a little bit about that experience before you moved into the investment world.
Yeah, no, I definitely took a non-traditional route to investments. I worked for the government of Southern Sudan before they were independent from Sudan, working on lobbying efforts with the US government to really get support for the outcome of the referendum. So South Sudan was seeking to become independent. There had been a lot of conflict over resources, over religion, over land, and they wanted to be a separate country. And so my work was to really uphold the outcome of the referendum and also get support from the US government, both reputationally as well as monetary support in holding the referendum. South Sudan is one of the poorest countries in the world, and having the resources to make sure that everybody was able to vote was incredibly important.
And what was the outcome of the referendum?
South Sudan became an independent country. Since then, it has disintegrated into civil war, which, again, over resources, over power, there are tribal elements to it. So I ask people not to judge me on the outcome. It's definitely still a country that's very near to my heart. I'm involved with a charity there and continue to do development work with non-governmental organizations.
And what kind of fascinates me about your background is that it's not the traditional investment background, even just looking at your education. So my take on that would be that you would have different perspectives to bring to the table in terms of an investment discussion. So maybe tell us a little bit how you then moved into the world of investments after working on that campaign.
I guess working with the government of Southern Sudan mission and seeing how policy and governments can come into play, you also see that it's not just regulation and policy making that you need to have an impact and really to affect change. You need private sector buy-in and you need investment from both public and private sector. So it really turned me on to thinking how can you marry the two and what are the other opportunities to advancing some of these policies that we want to see in place. And that led me to looking at public investment through financial firms and the like.
And so you moved then over to, well, back to Scotland, because you were working in the States, I believe, on the campaign for Sudan. So you started working in the big bad world of investments, and you came to impact investing. And what was it that attracted you most about impact investing?
So impact investing was really a way to blend what I'd learned on the development side and what I'd learned through looking at how governments work and how regulations operate, and also how these worlds are really, I had a professor who called them two sides of the same coin. So you marry economics with government, and policy making and economics are really driven by the companies that build up an economy, and seeing how you can actually affect change on that side to hopefully mirror the changes that you want to see on the political side. So I was given the opportunity to work in finance, meet hundreds of companies, speaking to their CEOs, learning about their strategies, their policies, how they're thinking about investing, the countries that they're investing in, and looking at how they are structuring their strategy to really focus on multiple different beneficiaries, whether that's shareholders, whether that's the customers that they're serving, the people within the supply chains. So it was really an interesting opportunity and a way to, I guess, blend two passions.
Absolutely. When you think about that range of stakeholders there must have been a huge variance in both motivations and I suppose KPIs or outcomes for those stakeholders. Is there a wide range and what kind of spectrum are we talking about there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in the 10 years or the decade I've been doing this, I mean, I think when I first started, you barely heard companies talk about ESG investing, let alone impact investing. And now I think as we've seen the world change, as we've seen the customers from my point of view, so the clients that I see that want to invest their pensions, as they've evolved and you've seen younger generations get involved, their demands on how their money is invested has changed. And that, again, changes the conversations that you have with a lot of these CEOs and these companies. And similarly, the workforce has changed. We're a more globalized world. There's more information. So there's greater scrutiny on how workers survive in different working conditions and also the environmental impact of products and the operations. So it's definitely moved on from we're just benefiting shareholders and we're just running a company to make money and pay our shareholders and our debt holders to let's look at a range of beneficiaries.
Sarah, I think your fund actually launched when I was working in impact investing in Guatemala in 2017. And I always talk about it almost being a responsible investment journey because it was a bit philosophical in that you were testing existing beliefs around financial return and risk to arrive at this process that all of a sudden incorporated a concept called impact, which is still, you know, is defined in different ways by different people. So I'm interested to learn a little bit more about the journey that you took within Aberdeen Standard Investments to develop an impact investment process.
Yeah, we initially started out on the impact journey because we had a client come to us and say they wanted a fund built around certain principles and their own definition of impact. And as we were working with this client and also involving our own thinking internally of what impact investing means to us, our definition evolved beyond what the client had initially asked for. And so we decided to come up with an impact product that was not just one client led, but that was fit for multiple different clients and trying to be a bit broader in our thinking and more, I guess, accessible rather than one client's definition of impact investing.
And within your group of people, obviously, you know, you're coming from a very interesting background with the subjects that you've studied and your experience with the challenges Sudan was facing. You were maybe working with a team of people that are more traditional in terms of their education and their work experience. Was there any kind of conflicts in terms of where you balance impact versus financial return or those types of discussions that maybe got a little heated at times?
I think it was definitely a journey. I'm very fortunate in that the people that I worked with to set this up, we all had the same motivation and the same, I guess, I call it belief system. So we're all very passionate about driving impact. There was, I guess, some differing opinions on how do we define impact. So we know impact is intentional and it must be measurable, but what is positive social and environmental change? What do we actually mean by that? There's the debate around nuclear energy, for example. Is that a positive or is it a negative? You can have different viewpoints. So what we did is we really used the Sustainable Development Goals, which had come out around the same time that we were looking at the product, to say that's how we're going to define social and environmental change for the better. So rather than me as a fund manager sitting and saying, well, this is my belief system and this is what I think is important, or speaking to one client and having them tell us what it was important, or a colleague saying this is what's important, we decided to kind of outsource that definition, if you will, to a higher authority. Now, we can debate whether the UN is the right authority or not, but it has become a widely accepted standard. I don't think there was ever a debate around should we prioritize impact or finance. I'm incredibly lucky in that I have a team of like-minded investors behind me that are all very supportive of the double bottom line, so achieving both financial return and impact.
One of the things that as we went through kind of developing an impact investment process, we were thinking about, right, what is the impact of a company? How do we look at their financials and stuff like that? And we kind of arrived at a point where we said, okay, there's obviously the risk spectrum, there's a return spectrum. And we said, you know what, there's an impact spectrum as well, because, you know, you might have some companies who are thinking about stakeholders and their business models. Others are thinking about tackling social challenges. Other firms might have just come up with a transformational product. So we were saying, okay, we'll balance, we could have a company that has a high financial return possibility, let's say a relatively low impact score, versus a company that their financial return may not be as high, but the impact is much higher. And we were looking at trying to potentially balance a collection of companies within the fund to deliver a net impact and net return. Is that the type of model that you guys pursue, or are you much more, this is our baseline standard in terms of impact, and then the financials have to justify an investment in this company no matter what their level of impact is?
Yeah, for us, impact is binary. It's either you're having a positive impact or you don't qualify for the impact portfolio. I think what you're talking about, the impact rating, it's a very powerful tool when you're maybe working with a private organization, an NGO, a government organization, where you have all the data available to be able to score impact. For listed equities, and I guess this is my view, we don't yet have that complete data set. So for me to say that one beneficiary deserves impact more than somebody else is very, very difficult. That's me inserting my own beliefs into the equation. So for us, we have a very standard baseline, as you say. So what is impact? It is the intent to deliver a positive or social or environmental outcome. And for us, that's looking at how is a company investing? What is their strategy and how are they investing behind that strategy? And is that aligned to a specific social and environmental goal?
I mean, intent is a nice word, I guess. Action is a better word, I guess. How do you make sure that it's not just a bunch of companies talking about the possibility of delivering an impact and they're actually doing things that are delivering a material change? That's what I want to see.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, 100%. I mean, I did my thesis on discourse analysis and how different actors can co-opt a word or a language for their own benefit and really manipulate it and take away from what it actually was supposed to mean. And I think for us, anybody can talk a good talk, and you're right, you need to walk the walk as well. And the way we look at that is it's not just a company saying they're going to do something. So you have all the automakers saying they're going to look at EVs. You have all the oil companies saying they're going to look at renewable energy. It's actually where you're investing the bulk of your budget. So is that in R&D designed to deliver electric vehicles and drive an energy revolution? Is it taking all of that CapEx spend away from oil exploration and looking at renewable energy? And if it's not, if you don't have that investment budget, that action behind the intent, you're really greenwashing or rainbow washing, and it's not as pure an impact. I mean, every company has a positive or negative impact, and we, in the listed equity space, I guess for our portfolio, we're not trying to look at what's your net impact. We're trying to look for companies that have as close to 100% positive impact as possible. I think if you start going into that net impact debate, it's very difficult in a listed equity space because we don't have the exchange rate between environmental outcomes and social outcomes. So I don't know what's more important. Is it the hydroelectric dam, or is it the displaced population that you need to move to build that hydroelectric dam? So we try and avoid those companies.
So basically what it sounds like, Sarah, is it's that subjective element. So if clients or investment committees want to prioritize social impact over environmental impact, that's their decision. But as an impact investment manager, you don't make that choice. You apply a very strict framework. You want to deliver impact and you want to deliver return.
Yes, very much so.
And then when you came to actually, I know you've relied on this sustainable development goals. There's a lot of research that they've put out. They've got their 17 goals. And then you arrived at an 8-pillar framework for your fund. So can you maybe kind of tell us a little bit about that and how that helps find opportunities?
Yeah, so the sustainable development goals, I'm sure everybody listening has heard of them in some capacity or another, but they're very much the world's goals and I guess the world's action plan on social and environmental objectives, but they're very much for countries and not for companies or for investors. So what we've done is we've tried to consolidate them down into 8 investable themes, where companies can align their products and services with these themes. And linking back to the Sustainable Development Goals as a starting point, but more broadly, what is the UN's framework and what is the UN's agenda? Because that's constantly changing. So for us, impact isn't static. It is very much fluid. And as the world's change, as the world's needs change and evolve, we want to be aligned as closely as possible with the UN directive on this.
Great. Can I ask just a very quick question about the impact and the pillars help to outline clearly what you guys are looking at in that sense. When you look about the structure of the company, do you look about their own setup? So do you look at things like their diversity inclusion agenda within their own organization, their own carbon footprint, that kind of stuff?
Definitely. So I think impact is part of a spectrum of capital. I mean, impact is not the only way that you can allocate your funds and your resources to positively aligned outcomes. And when you look at sustainability products focusing on how a company's operations are put together and how a company is run, you can think of impact as the next iteration of that. So when we're looking at companies, we're starting with companies with our buy ideas because we have a financial objective, so companies we like financially. Then we're reviewing their environmental, social and governance framework. Do they have environmental policies? How do they treat their workforce? What is the diversity, governance issues around taxes and board structure? And then we're looking for impact. So we want companies to go through several different phases before we even start to look for an impact angle to make sure that, again, we're trying to avoid that net impact argument. So they might be doing something fantastic from an impact product point of view, but their operations are less up to standard.
Absolutely. I'm really, really interested in the fact that you wrote your thesis in discourse analysis, mostly because you're probably the third person that I've met that was interested in discourse analysis. So which is great. I wonder if you look at the plethora of marketing material and prospectuses that are available, would you see a significant similarity in the language used, and you know, without having studied it, I would say rigorously, I would say yes, you would. But also, I'm really interested in the psychology as to the why that is. Like, is it? Yeah, I'm interested in your view of it as well.
I think you're probably seeing me shake my head. Yes, over the last decade, you've seen language start to move in one direction, and now most companies use the same language. They all reference the Sustainable Development Goals. They all have the same objectives. They've all got the same glossy annual reports with similar images. And you're seeing that harmonization in a way that it actually makes looking for companies that are having a positive impact much more difficult. I would rather a company not reference the Sustainable Development Goals, not use that language, because then you're actually getting down to what is a company actually trying to do with its strategy, rather than a company is trying to greenwash its business because it's seen the industry moving in this direction. So the companies are very aware of the changes that are going on, both from consumers, from regulators, and within my industry, from investors. And they're trying to do as much as possible to attract new capital into the business, whether that's through debt, whether that's through equity, or whether that's through new consumers. And by using this language, I think there's the understanding or the expectation that will help improve their chances of this. And it's no longer necessarily that intent, and it's no longer authentic. It's much more you have to do it. So when I see large oil companies or tobacco companies saying we align with the Sustainable Development Goals, I go, yeah, you probably do in some parts of your operations. But when you think about the ultimate product that you're producing and the whole reason that you exist as a business, you're going against what the UN is trying to achieve. So you including that language, you including those icons, yeah, it doesn't resonate as well with me. It's very jarring.
I suppose it depends, though, on what company in the end of the day, because if you do have somebody using the framework right, it makes your job a whole lot easier if you're all aligned on the same page. So I suppose it depends. It comes back to whether or not the executives in the company is genuine.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it requires meeting with these executives. So I'm very fortunate in that we do thousands of meetings a year, have very good access to CEOs, to chairmen of the board, to middle management, so you're able to sense check what you're reading in the annual report and in the presentations by having conversations with these managers. And oftentimes the managers are aligned with all the literature. Other times managers sit there and say, well, you're the first person that's ever asked me about that. I'm going to have to get back to you on that, because while it's part of the marketing literature, if you will, and while they're using the right language, they don't actually believe it. And it is really just words on a page rather than a belief system.
And, you know, my issue with the whole thing, corporate social responsibility, obviously we've been talking about that for 50 years or more now at this stage. That's pretty much been a failure because it just turned into a marketing exercise. ESG has real potential if it's actually implemented at a decision-making level. So if you're thinking about your ideal company in terms of moving forward over the next 10 or 15 years and actually, let's say, applying the frameworks, not in a genuine way, how do you think these companies can better implement decision-making that incorporates this stuff rather than having more and more of these glossy magazines that said they're applying ESG or applying the Sustainable Development Goals and we're doing this and we're doing that, but in the end of the day, the man or the woman in the big seat, the CEO, says something different to what's in the actual marketing magazine. So what would your recommendation, I suppose, to these executives that are saying, we didn't really think about that before?
I think it comes back to one of the words you used earlier, is revolutionary. You want companies to be revolutionary rather than reactionary. So rather than trying to retrofit your business to fit these ESG principles or these impact principles, you need to look forward and say, okay, what are the problems in my industry that I can address with my business? And then how can I adapt my business to those problems? How can I forward-looking change my investment budget to reflect whether that's operationally ESG considerations or whether that's from an impact perspective, looking at my own products and services to really address some of these problems? And I think those are the companies that identifying the problem, allocating the investment, ultimately making revenue, and then coming on to measuring the impact, those are the ones that are going to succeed. And I think those are the ones that are going to be here in 10, 20, 30, 50 years, versus companies like the oil companies in the oil industry or banks in their current form, auto industry. There are lots of industries that are going to go through fundamental changes, I think. And you really need a CEO that is visionary and looking forward rather than trying to, as I said, retrofit a business that might not fit for purpose anymore.
Yeah. I mean, revolutionary is what I thought when I first came across impact investing in Guatemala, because it kind of does force you to rethink business and investment. Tell you a quote here from Sir Ronald Cohen, or my friend Ronnie, as Bono calls him. He's a former venture capitalist. He was involved in social impact bonds in the UK. You can pretty much hear plenty of videos from him on YouTube talking about impact investing. He said, for me, the impact revolution is going to be as pervasive as the tech revolution. And when I hear revolution, I think Viva la Revolución, El Che, Che Guevara. But I'm just wondering, is impact investing, the more it's gone mainstream, is it at risk of losing that revolutionary aspect of it? Because people are thinking, oh, impact investing, it's slightly different from traditional investing, but, you know, it's not really revolutionary.
I think we need greater understanding about what impact investing is. I think there's a danger that you see, as I said, in rainbow washing. So using those SDGs to kind of cover old products without actually making changes to the mandates, or even I once had a colleague say, he was like, the best way to look and see a sustainability product versus a standard product or an impact product versus a standard product is comparing the holdings. And if they're the same, there's a high chance that there is rainbow washing or green washing. But if they are completely different, then you might be onto something. And I guess that's a good first kind of sniff test, if you will, to see, is something actually that revolutionary, or is it just trying to repurpose an existing vehicle and retain those old holdings? I think if you get greater education around what is impact investing, it becomes harder to fake it, because there are quite a lot of required elements. So the IFC has its own definitions and its own standards. You've got the Global Impact Investing Network coming out with their own standards. You've got Bridges Ventures, and then you've got the EU taxonomy. So the more we can coalesce around a specific definition, you have less chance of it becoming greenwashed. And then I guess to your question, do you want it to be revolutionary? I mean, my goal would be to see impact investing replacing mainstream investing. So maybe it's less revolutionary, but it has completely replaced how we think about investing. And then you are focusing on companies that are solving specific problems. And it might not be that you get the creator of an iPod equivalent every year, but you're making incremental changes and delivering social and environmental outcomes that are for the better.
Absolutely. And in a way, the whole point of revolution is to change what mainstream is and to make it, to bring it into to realities. And actually, you mentioned Che Guevara, and who is, you know, the one of the most iconic revolutionaries that there was, regardless of where you sit on his politics and his actions. But if you go to where he's buried, which is Santa Clara in Cuba, it's probably as close to commercialism that Cuba gets to, in terms of there's a gift shop there, you know, really big monument, loads of tour buses coming in and out for people to pay respects in one sense, but also just to get the selfie beside Che Guevara's grave. So they're like, the concept of an everlasting revolution can't exist. Like, it'll either fail or it becomes par for the course.
But that's why they say vive la revolution. It's like, long live the revolution. You have to keep the revolution going, because once it becomes mainstream, the revolution is over. That's the meaning of it, really. Like, so I think once you go, okay, impact investing is mainstream, the revolution is over at the end of the day. Not to be sounded like too militant on the subject.
I guess what would my question would then be, what would your objective from the revolution be?
Okay. Well, first of all, I take a step back. Where are the origins of impact investing in the philanthropic space? What is the philanthropic space trying to do? They're trying to put money to work in the likes of Guatemala, Mexico, emerging markets, developing countries that have serious social challenges, right? So they're trying to create an ecosystem in developing countries to actually improve the situation for people living in these countries. That's ultimately what's revolutionary about impact investing on the ground in that part of the world. When you go a bit more mainstream, let's say, and you've got the positive thing is you've got more capital at work. So you've got a lot more traditional money, let's say, going to work in these areas and even in developed markets where you look. But the problem, I suppose, is if the likes of these big private equity funds come down under the flag of impact investing and go across Latin America and take advantage of these countries, as has been done in the past, then impact investing is just another form of colonialization. So it's like, that's my, actually, like, I like the idea that potentially on the more mainstream side, that you, in your work, you can put more pressure on companies to actually deliver more of an impact. I really like that. Where I'm a little bit more concerned in terms of talking about a revolution is that where impact investing originated was to develop ecosystems in developing countries. Now you're seeing the much bigger private equity firms come down into these countries. And while they might care about impact, $2 billion private equity firms aren't going down to Latin America to just improve the situation for the people in Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua. They have a very, very clear mandate to deliver nice returns for their investors, which again isn't the problem. There's a balance between return and impact, and it's investors that need to make those decisions. But when we talk about impact investing being revolutionary, I think the most potential it has in that traditional space is to bring the living standards of the developing world up. That's ultimately what its objective should be. Again, we've societal challenges in the developed world as well, where the big companies that you work with maybe more focused. But that's my take on it.
I think I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that comes back to what is impact investing, and it's not thematic investing in that you're aligned with a social theme or an environmental theme. It's looking at what is an unmet need. And as you say, there are unmet needs in emerging markets, there are unmet needs in developed markets. And a company really has to be allocating its resources to addressing those unmet needs, not just thematically, whether that's sustainable energy or financial inclusion with any type of bank, for example. You want to be investing in financial institutions in a specific country where there's low penetration of financial services, they're providing literacy, they've got interest rates that aren't gouging their customers and going to push their customers into bankruptcy, and they're actually driving a social change. And I think that's why impact investing, you have to remember that the definition requires measurement as well. And if you can't measure the impact that you are having, are you really having an impact? And do you have that pure impact objective? Or coming back to the question, is it just greenwashing? Is it rainbow washing?
Yeah, I think, look, I think it's fair for people in places like Latin America and Africa, regions that have suffered at the hands of colonialization, that they actually take a good look at the capital that's coming into their country and the objectives of that capital, because creating 10 jobs may not necessarily be the impact you want if it destroys everybody's environment, you know. And that's the way companies work as well in the emerging markets, is that they divide and conquer. It's quite simple, you know. You see the mining companies go down. If you've got no job and somebody all of a sudden is telling you, we got a job for you, well, that sounds great, but the other 100 people that are going to suffer in terms of their water being affected, you know, that's another issue, you know. So you divide these villages. So I really do feel excited about impact investing, and I think it has huge potential. I just hope that, and I think it comes back to an education thing, that the people that are putting in money into these funds, they understand where the money is going, and that, you know, we have challenges locally, but we have massive inequality globally that needs to be addressed. And I know that's reading some of your literature, you know, social inequalities are rising, consumption and production remains unsustainable. So you can quite clearly see that these issues are at play. And I think I'm interested, I suppose, when you look at your portfolio, then you're in public equity. So you've got big companies within those eight pillars. You know, we talked about financial inclusion, which is a big issue in the developing markets. How do you make sure, though, that big financial company that is going down to the emerging markets, that they're not, you know, taking advantage of customers? You know, we've talked previously, to buy a washing machine or any kitchen appliance, you go in and get it on credit, you're paying double of what it costs. So it's not easy to hold companies accountable for that type of behavior.
And I think within our focus on financial inclusion, which is one of our pillars, we don't have very many large banks. So your developed market US or European banks, it's a bit harder to identify a company who's having an impact through a significant amount of their investment budget. Instead, we're invested in microfinance institutions. One company used to be backed by an NGO, backed by Bill and Melinda Gates. And so they benchmark the interest rates that they charge their clients off of other NGOs. They're focused predominantly on female entrepreneurs in countries where there's poor or very low access to financial services. They use World Bank database data to really identify these countries. And then their job doesn't stop just when they've given the money. They're then working with these communities, creating networks in communities so women can share best practices about how they're actually finding running a business, how they're using the money. And they don't lend more than a woman can pay back. So they're lending a very small amount, say less than $50 a month, and are letting a woman build up, learn how to spend that money, learn how to deliver the returns before they actually lend even more. And they work on payment terms. So they're also very cognizant that extreme weather events or family issues can derail a business. So you want a company that is that invested. And it comes back to, that's the business's intent, to deliver financial returns, but also to have a positive social environmental impact. And for this company, it's very much to have that positive social impact and create that, what they call a virtuous cycle of wealth that is built into their purpose. And that's the kind of company we're looking for. We're looking for mission-led businesses, not just a big bank that might have some exposure to an underserved demographic in one region. It's very much, how are they actually changing the community in that specific country?
Great. And that's wonderful. And actually, that's a really good practical example of the empowerment of the local economy to be able to take advantage of an impact investment. It's something that I've always struggled with a little bit. And I'll go back to the first episode of this series, where Vincent was talking about his experience in Guatemala and the structure of the company down there. What heartened me about that was that it was 50%, roughly 50% locals, and then 50% more international people. But there's always a fear, and it's harking back to the colonial days as well, is that this is just another. Another way, a well-meaning way of the Western world coming to emerging markets, going, this is how you should be doing it. So when it can be led by local communities as much as possible, to make sure that their cultural differences are respected and continued, and that their environment is protected as well, I think is really important.
Local content is extremely important. It comes back to your question around that ESG integration and how a company runs itself. Is a company going in to take advantage, whether through its operations and its supply chain or through the end product, or is it actually thinking about its role as a business in a society or community?
Absolutely. And in terms of you're incredibly articulate in how you explain the purpose and the mission of the company and the importance of that. And I was struck as well by your piece at the start about you've been lucky that you've managed to work with people who share your belief systems. But for me, the individual leader and their own purpose in terms of aligning to the environment and to society is a huge part of it. I know many companies have their own values and their own missions, and they're very clear on websites and on walls around the world. But I wonder, in terms of individuals working in the sector, how close they are to their own values and how their own personal values actually interact with their companies.
I think you're seeing more of that. I definitely think you're seeing, anytime we're interviewing for a new hire, we get a question around what is the culture of the business? What are the values? And you can often see the individuals kind of their thinking, does that align with my own belief system? Does that align with my own values? And are they feeding me a line, or do the interview viewers actually look like they believe it? So I do get a lot of questions about that. I get a lot of new hires and grads asking to sit down and say, okay, talk me through the product, talk me through the process, but also talk to me how you got here and why you're doing it. So that's a key question I also get from clients. Why are you doing this? Tell me about what it actually means to you. And I think you can't, in my opinion, be involved in impact investing and not believe that it's going to work, not believe that you have to be doing it to affect change. It's one part of that puzzle. And coming back to that spectrum of capital, whether it's the private sector, the public sector, governments, consumers, I mean, we all have that role to play. And you actually have to believe that your role can matter. If you're just doing it because there's client demand, I don't think that you're ever going to really get the process quite right, in my opinion. It just comes back to that. I don't even know how to put it into words, but it comes back to that belief system. It really has to be internalized. I mean, when you speak to companies, you can tell right off the bat, does the CEO actually believe that the environmental social strategy that they're articulating, or is it something that their marketing team has said they have to say? It's just, you can sense it in a company and in a management meeting. And that's why it's so important not just to read the literature, where you can be fooled by the words that are used, but actually have that conversation with the manager.
Yeah. I mean, if you're like me with this stuff, you're probably thinking through on a daily and weekly basis why this matters, and I suppose where your own beliefs lie, because I think it's something that you have to kind of test yourself. You've got 1,600 stocks in the MSCI world, right? How many companies actually fit the bill? How many companies you can look at, say, okay, those guys, they're genuine, they're doing good things, we want to be invested in them. The financials might not be right today, but at some point when the prices are right, we'd like to be invested in these companies.
So out of those 1,600, I guess, ideas that you could invest in MSCI, at Aberdeen Standard Investments, we probably have about 1,100 buy ideas at any one time. And that's really where we start to look for impact. So as I said, we marry financial and impact, and there are different ways to go about it. You can look for impact cases and then make the financial cases fit, or you can look for financial cases and then make the impact analysis. And we just play to our strength. We are a fundamental bottom-up stock picking company. So we start with our buy ideas. And out of those buy ideas, there are probably about 150 companies that we think qualify for our impact portfolio. And then the portfolio itself is between 30 and 60 companies. At the moment, it's about 45. So it is very constrained.
But isn't it, if you think about it, it's quite an easy process, in that you have your 8 pillars, you have your 150 stocks. Like if you have your baseline impact standard, then you have your 150 that meet that baseline. That realistically isn't going to change within a year. So you can ignore the rest of the universe. And then you can have 150 stocks that you look at from a valuation perspective and a risk perspective and assess them and say, okay, this is where we see a price level that suits. And you just go from there. And when prices change within your universe,
you make changes. I mean, since doing this, I mean, you are seeing new ideas added to that impact universe. And that's what I love to see, because I do tell clients this, we leave impact on the table by starting with financial first. I mean, that is a decision that we've made, and that's how we're achieving that double bottom line of financial return and impact. So there are some brilliant companies out there that are having a significant impact, but we just don't like the valuations at the moment. They're not a buy idea. So as my team is looking at the financial cases and looking for new ideas, it's exciting to see what other ideas come into the universe and give us other opportunities, because within that 150 buy idea universe, I mean, markets change. You've seen rapid changes at the moment, given the virus impact. So you always want to have more ideas in your back pocket to be able to change the composition of the portfolio.
But that 150 is defined first by the impact.
Yes. So they're all buy ideas, and they all...
Based on impact.
No, they were all financial ideas first. They were all financially attractive first. And then we did the impact analysis, and they meet that baseline of impact. So that's what I'm saying. That's our process, is we look at our buy ideas first, and then we look for impact.
Okay. My take on it maybe is the other way around, and I was interested to hear what you feel about that. But if I take 1,600 companies in the MSCI, realistically, I can't see any more than 100 meeting 150, as you said, meeting a good impact standard, like in terms of your criteria across all stakeholders, because as you say, it's relatively new. So my understanding will be that at least if you had your impact universe defined, then all you're doing is moving around based on where the prices have moved. So you could say this company is excellent from an impact perspective. They're in our 150, but you know what? Priced at $100 a share, they're only worth 50. When they come down to 50, we'll look at them. Would that be a simpler way of looking at it?
So you get a bit of that, but then also within our pillars, so some ideas are a lot easier to identify than others. So environmental ideas are a lot easier to identify than social ideas. So at the moment, we're struggling for companies that are having that are very financially attractive, as well as having a positive impact within the food and agriculture space. I think you've got a lot of agriculture companies that will be quite significantly geared into harvest cycles and seasons and extreme weather events recently that make the prices very volatile. So from a financial perspective, it's very hard to find an attractive idea, despite maybe having elements of vertical farming, fertigation, hydroponics, all these different sustainable agriculture techniques that the UN has recommended. So we're constantly looking for new ideas. Could this company be financially attractive because we like the impact characteristics? I mean, you're constantly looking for those ideas. And that's why I say I would want to see the universe grow, because at the moment, the companies that are financially attractive at the moment might not fit every single one of the pillars.
Yeah. And previously when we were chatting, we were talking about the baseline standard of impact. And you mentioned that within certain companies in the US where they're very poor on parental leave for mothers. I know Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that you take a puppy away from its mother after 8 weeks, but you send the mother of a little baby back to work after 6 weeks. So there's something wrong with that dynamic. And you were mentioning that that's one of the things that you look for within the companies that you invest in.
Exactly. So we're looking at companies not just within a global context, but also within their specific markets. And are they actually changing and challenging a lot of the standard way of thinking in these markets? So when we're looking at companies that are providing or having an impact on employment, for example, it's what are the maternal care policies? And the company we were talking about, they offer maternal care policies in line with Europe versus in line with the US, much better pay, much better support, shared paternity leave, and then a transition for these women to get them back into the workforce. And that's incredibly important in the US, as you say, where it almost feels backward versus the rest of the world in terms of how they take care of new mothers.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I suppose the longer the fund, like the fund is in place now 3 years. So I guess the longer it goes on, the more data you've built up and you're probably creating more clarity around the metrics that you want to use in what sector and what pillar.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I mean, we start, our baseline for impact is looking at a company's strategy and their investment budget. And for us, it must be a material amount of the investment budget. So over a third. And then the remaining two thirds, if you will, have to be neutral. So it's not again, coming back to that net impact, great, you're investing in renewables, but bad, you're investing in extraction, which I guess is just an easy example. It has to be positive and neutral rather than positive and negative, just because we don't want to look for that impact. And then as we've developed this, you've seen more standardization. I mentioned the IFC, I mentioned the EU taxonomy around how we report on impact and what actually constitutes a sustainable activity. And we're working to continually adapt our reporting. Reporting is equally important as the financial, because I mean, that is your impact return. If you can't report on your impact, you're not actually having an impact return. And that's half of the equation of impact investing. So working with companies to improve their disclosure is incredibly important and a huge part of the engagement that we do.
Yeah. In terms of the barriers that you're seeing, like, you obviously talk to investment committees who are asset owners for big pools of capital. You're talking about impact investing. It might be the first time that they've heard about impact investing. What kind of challenges are you running into?
I think it's the education piece. As you mentioned, I mean, people don't necessarily understand what is impact investing. How is it different? Is it really revolutionary? Is it not just standard sustainable investing slightly tweaked? What do you mean by an impact return? How do you report on impact? How is that different versus other impact funds? Because there's no standardization for reporting. So the way our portfolio reports is very different to how other portfolios report. And I mean, I'm a bit of a data geek, so I like more data, but some clients don't necessarily want that. They just want the nice picture around what is the company actually doing. Coming back to the financial inclusion example, the company is providing access to financial services for underserved women in emerging markets, and that's enough. They don't want to know what percentage of the women are actually, how that equates to the total number of people that don't have access to finance. So this is really the impact that the company is having at a country level. Other companies or other clients just want to see examples around, you've saved X amount of carbon, that equates to X number of flights between Dublin and New York. And that's as far as they want to go. They want that impact calculator, if you will. So we're trying to structure it to give clients as much information as they want. So a bit like an onion, very much tiered and layered. But I mean, I think that will come.
Absolutely. But the data is critical to all of this, both in terms of improving how the investments are made in the future, but also as you said, to measure the impact of the impact. In terms of the visualization of that for people who aren't as data literate as you may be, and the example of the flights between London and New York is a key example. But are there any other useful data visualization or explanation techniques that you use to get the message across?
So we use kind of that impact calculator. So amount of water that has been cleaned and sanitation services relative to the total capacity, I guess, of the Aviva Stadium, for example, or amount of waste that has been recycled relative to total number of elephants or blue whales, just to try and give that example and put it into a real life context, and number of users equivalent to average monthly Twitter users. So you get an idea of the scale of the impact being delivered, as well as those case studies. I think that's really what brings it to life. Companies that are providing products that help reduce methane emissions from cow belching, that kind of story stays with you. And I think a lot of clients want to see that. And it's, my money is going towards these solutions, and that makes it that much more tangible.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And you mentioned that, you're linked to the Sustainable Development Goals 2030. We're 5 years in, 10 years to go. What are your thoughts in terms of reaching those goals, or have we got a new plan around the corner when we reach 2030?
Yeah, I think the world really needs a swift kick to kind of jumpstart a lot of this. I think we've been talking about this for the last 5 years. You've seen some regulation. I think you've seen the Green New Deal in Europe and some other very strong moves by governments. But now you actually need to see investment. You need to see whether that's government incentives for green infrastructure, public buy-in, private buy-in. And rather than just talking about what we're going to do, you now need to see the action. So it's a bit disheartening to see COP26 delayed, especially because it was going to be in Scotland, which was very exciting. So delayed to next year. You can kind of understand why, given all the COVID implications and the health concerns. But having seen Madrid be, I guess, fall short of expectations, you were really counting on Glasgow actually stepping up and actually seeing some actions from that.
But I guess these conferences tend to do that. We get a lot of kind of showboating and the follow through isn't always great. So I guess we need more action.
Well, and that's why I think it's not just governments. I think you do need all actors. And that's coming back to, can you have an impact in a listed space? I think you do need to see some of these big corporations changing their business models and changing how they operate to meet these goals. I mean, countries aren't going to meet these emission targets on their own. They need to see fundamental changes in how consumers spend on energy, what types of energy they use, as well as businesses in terms of how they're thinking about their own operations and then companies offering new and innovative services.
We're recording in the middle of the corona crisis, and every day you get more information, and the way things have progressed, it seems that more people are actually asking some of the questions, because all of this really boils down to resource allocation, whether it be at a private level or a public level. And, you know, you're seeing, for instance, in the UK, one of the ministers there put it to the soccer players, oh, they make X amount every week, they should pay. And then, you know, at the same time, you're saying, okay, well, the bankers are making this, and then somebody else can say, well, you're making that. The teacher can say to the politician, well, you've got a pension that's worth 5 million. So there's it's almost like triggering massive questions along the whole economic system in terms of how resources are allocated. Even the professional footballers are saying, you know what, we're okay with paying into this, but we're not giving our money to you guys in charge in the suits in the boardroom, because we don't trust you. We're going to set up our own fund and put it towards the NHS, which is effectively saying we are going to be in charge of allocating our own resources. So I think I'm interested in what you think, but I do feel that even the average person on the street, when it comes back to things like football and that ecosystem, more and more people are going to be starting, their mind is going to start opening a little bit and going, hold on a second, where's that money going? What are we doing with that? Why are we not funding our healthcare system? Why do we not have these social safety nets in place? Hopefully we emerge from this quickly, but I think whenever it is, I think those questions are going to be asked.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely going to see fundamental changes in society, and not just how we behave, but how we think about using our vote. So you saw the Green Revolution across Europe and a lot of Green parties gaining more representation in Ireland as well. And I think you're now going to see that social agenda also come into play. And politicians are going to be held to account, because, I mean, the massive health crisis that we've seen from COVID and the lack of safety nets for average workers who might have been forced out of work because of the virus, and the significant economic damage from not having enough safety nets in place is going to resonate with a lot of these people. And each one, remember, has a vote. So I think you're going to start to see a fundamental change in, hopefully, or at least I hope you're going to see a fundamental change in how governments are put together and the focuses that they have.
Absolutely. It's really interesting that, that you know, obviously with the significant health and safety of our global citizens being to the forefront of everybody's mind, how the politics of the pandemic are coming a little bit more to the fore, absolutely, in terms of how people allocate tax, but even in terms of who, you know, the World Health Organization, how that operates and how it acts on information it gets based on political boundaries and political allegiances. So I think it's throwing a spotlight on that. Like there's an interesting situation emerging in Ireland at the moment, which is the country is divided into the north and the republic, and those who live in the north but work in the south are not entitled to the COVID payment if they've lost their job or income, even though they pay their taxes completely in the Republic. So whilst that would have emerged, I'm sure, in other situations over the years, it has never to this extent. But again, it's just shining a spotlight. And by the way, a spotlight that is not easily answered, but on the politics of the situation.
No, definitely. And I would hope that spotlight stays. It doesn't get shut off as soon as the virus is contained. I do think society has fundamentally changed from these few weeks on lockdown, and also, I guess, the consideration we give for the workers on the front line. So not just in the UK, the NHS, or the doctors and the nurses, but also the people that are continuing to drive buses and keep that public transportation system running for these critical workers to get to their jobs, as well as the people that are staffing the grocery shops, and more importantly, the delivery drivers that are constantly funneling those packages back and forth, as we all probably do a bit too much online shopping as we're confined in our homes. So it's all these different individuals that you might not have prioritized in your thinking, in your thought process previously. I would hope that they stay a focus when it comes to the next round of elections and policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I know you've got a lot to do today, so we'll let you go. But thank you very much for coming on the podcast. And it's been really interesting to hear your insights.
No, thank you very much for having me. It was great to chat.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the ESG Factor. If you have any comments or questions on this episode or the show in general, please email theesgfactor@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This series is brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. ESG Ireland is an independent knowledge centre focused on delivering thought leadership, education and the latest developments on ESG in decision making. Find out more by visiting esg.ie or at ESG Ireland on social media. The Institute of Banking is a recognised college of UCD. It's a professional network of over 34,000 individuals working in financial services and is a centre of excellence in the provision of specialist education and lifelong learning to the financial services sector. Find out more by visiting iob.ie.